Roundtable Podcasts, underwritten by Proctors, the Capital Region's premier performing arts center featuring the best in entertainment from Broadway and around the globe. Proctors.org.
From his early 70s dispatches as a fledgling critic for the Village Voice on rock and roll, comedy, movies, and television, to the literary criticism of the 80s and 90s that made him famous, to his must-read cultural reporting for Vanity Fair, James Walcott has had a career as a freelance critic and a literary intellectual like none other. With his new career-spanning collection, Critical Mass, 4 decades of essays, reviews, hand grenades, and hurrahs, he gives us his best critical essays and cultural journalism. It's a great pleasure to welcome James Walcott back to the Roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us, sir. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you.
What is it like to put together a collection like this, to take a 4-decade survey of your work?
Part of the problem, the challenge, is simply getting the physical clips, because so much of the work I did, I didn't keep most of it, particularly of the early years, or I kept it, and then in moving around, I lost things. So I had a researcher. I mean, the hard part was getting the clips out of the Village Voice years, because there were hundreds of them, and they're not easy to find, they're not easy to read, and so pulling them together, and then others were easier to find once you move into the magazine years, but then you have to make the selection process. And my editor, Gerald Howard, you know, did his winnowing down, and I did mine. But essentially, you have to come out with, you have to basically, I ended up using maybe one piece out of the 30 I had written. And just a lot of things come into play, you know, in terms of, will it be dated? Will it not be dated? Will people get this referenced? Is it a controversy that we don't really want to revisit? You know, do we maybe just let it rest? So a lot of it is simply the whole winnowing down process.
I've always had this idea and a picture in my mind of authors who do this, of and I was so happy to see that you address this just in the first page of the book, which is that moment where you're sitting on the ground just with your work scattered all around you, looking at it and invariably putting it into piles.
Mm-hmm. Oh, sure. Well, you know, there are writers who are much smarter than I am about it, who decided very early on that they were going to have complete filing cabinets and have everything, you know, and they would even have their original drafts, you know, so their typewritten drafts and then the drafts they got back from the editor. I had, you know, I'm one of those people, I won't say I'm zen, but I thing was on to the next thing, so I didn't have it. So, you know, one of the things that you're amazed by when you see the work is, first of all, how much work you actually did, how productive you were, even though, you know, you didn't think so at the time, but also the gaps in terms of what you remember and what you don't remember in terms of what you're writing. You know, I would turn up pieces that I had no memory of writing.
You make the point in the introduction that you were always working. There was never a point where you went off for a period of time. You were always working.
That's true. I never took any real vacation or sabbatical. And even when I go away now, I'm usually working on something. I never had the year in London or the year in Paris or any of that. I never had the fellowship route or literary colony route where, okay, well, you have this one project you can work on for these months and you don't have to do anything else. I was always just, you know, I was very much a freelancer, and I have no, and at the time had no money of, you know, I had no trust fund. I didn't have any kind of backup money. So it was like I had to work or nothing else happened. I didn't have any money as a cushion to coast on. And so, no, I was always working. But, you know, I have to say, it was fun work. It was, you know, it was, for most part, it was, you know, it was fun. And it remains fun, because you don't want to get into the point where you feel like you're out going out into the prison yard and breaking the rocks.
You do make the point that with all of that said, there still is some nagging regret that maybe you could have done even more than you did.
I think I could have done more in the way of books, you know, writing complete books earlier on. although, you know, that may be unreasonable on my part in that because I had regular deadlines, you know, I couldn't really, it's very hard, you know, people sometimes think that you can sort of bisect your mind and, oh, I will work on this during the morning and early afternoon, then take a break, and then early evening I can do this. Now, there are writers who I think were able to do that. I think John Updike was probably able to do that, who can just smoothly go from one thing to another. But I find that when I'm writing a piece, the, whatever I'm working on becomes the obsessive object, and I can't then just flick it off. The one time I was able to was when I wrote a novel, and I wrote that in a very rigorous way. I mean, in a very kind of, I have 2 hours a day, and I write to it handwritten. But otherwise, it's hard. I do wish, you know, I mean, I look back, I think, oh, I, you know, I should have done a little bit more in this area, or a little bit more in that area. But those regrets really don't help you. You know, it's like, well, you know, you did what you did. It's like, you know, it's like, you know, you just have to keep pushing on.
You, the way the book is broken up is in very large subjects of whether it be television or movies or music or comedians. And it is it's a fascinating way, but it also shows us the topics that you seem to be drawn to.
Yeah, it's funny. A lot of times it doesn't become apparent until you break it down, but there's a lot in the book, and there's a lot I didn't include in the book. There's a lot on certain writers that were, I was always drawn back to, and I would fluctuate my reactions to them. Like, you know, there's John Updike, Gore Vidal, Norman Mailer. There are certain filmmakers that I always go back to: Brian De Palma, Sam Peckinpah, Michael Mann. And television, and this is an obsession that I have absolutely, of which zero remains, and that is, but I used to be very obsessed with, like, the, for example, late night television, when Johnny Carson was king, and when it was a real battle. Now there are so many shows, and they're so alike, and they're all pandering in the same way, that none of that interest remains. But I was very interested, the talk show format, when I came up in the 70s, was a really interesting, much more combative and argumentative, and also a higher level of intellectuality than it is today. Now it really is just people plugging their movies or their TV shows. But back then, I mean, you got an incredible array of guests. And sometimes, you know, the only way to really see that now is you go on YouTube and you can be sort of stunned at the guests that were on. I mean, that Andy Warhol and Edie Sedgwick were on the Merv Griffin show, for example. That Noam Chomsky used to be on talk shows, you know, Ira Stone, you know. And not only that, but the audiences were rowdier. I mean, there were times in the Dick Cavett audience, and when Dick Cavett had a show in New York, when audience members would yell from the balcony at the guests, and the guests would yell back. You know, if that happened now, they'd be like, we have to clear the studio. I'm sorry, this is unacceptable. So it was a much rowdier time.
You write a lot about, in Late Night in the book, you write a lot about Johnny Carson and David Letterman specifically. And given the close relationship of those two and the impact that certainly Carson has had on Letterman, it's interesting to see. And also worth noting that Letterman's also very much still a part of the scene.
He is. It doesn't look to me like he's enjoying it at all, but of course, when did he ever enjoy himself?
part of the fun, though.
You know, he was sort of doing the grumpy old guy before he was a grumpy old guy. Yeah, I don't know if I mentioned it in the book, but one of the great thrills of my life was after he had retired, I got a letter from Johnny Carson thanking me for something I had written. And, I mean, I was just stunned holding the letter and the envelope. I mean, it's just very, very hard to describe. And I'm at that state, you know, there are a lot of books coming out about Johnny Carson, including one that's already come out, that, you know, portray him as a very cold, angry, bitter, mean person.
Right.
And I'm like, it's probably all true, and I don't care. You know, I didn't have to live with him. I didn't have to work with him. I just go from what I saw on television. But that was a great throw. The irony is, in terms of David Letterman, was I was a guest on a test show that he did before the show went on the air. They did four or five shows in the theater, and I was on one of them, and it was never aired, but it was very interesting to be in that tiny little studio, and this is when he was just started on late night after his morning show.
And when you think about one of the things that I, you're absolutely right. All of this stuff is coming out about Carson. We just had Henry Bushkin on, who is his lawyer, who's written one of these books that is
Bombastic Bushkin. Yes.
Yes, Bombastic Bushkin. And it seems as though what gets lost is just how brilliant he was in dissecting what was going on in the world. And we have that to some extent with Jon Stewart now, but Johnny Carson is one of the few people that I truly miss on television.
Well, one of the things that was so amazing about Carson was his show really was a high wire act in that he could bomb on the air. I mean, his monologue sometimes bombed, and then he had savers, he had one-liners that he would come back with. But there were times when it didn't work. Now all of the comedians on late night who host shows, the audience is so whipped up to a frenzy before they come out that there's no way for them to fail. I mean, David Letterman gets a laughter and applause when he just adjusts his jacket and does a little shtick. It was a very high-level tension act that Carson did. And even though he wasn't overtly political, you sort of knew where his politics were. During the Watergate era, he was just like a laser beam on Richard Nixon. And that was very powerful. The other thing about Carson is he had a lot of interests. He was interested in astronomy. He was interested in Africa. He was interested in tennis. He went to Wimbledon. A lot of the people in show business now, it really is show business. That's the only thing, you know, that encircles them.
As you mentioned, much of what you write about is also about the literary and even your literary heroes. The book is in memory of Norman Mailer, Dan Wolfe, Clay Felker, Pauline Kael, and Gore Vidal, many of which you had mentioned earlier on, of I assume people that you're fascinated with, but people who have also inspired you.
All of them had a very big influence on the writing. Dan Wolfe was the editor of Village Voice. He didn't influence my writing, but he hired me when I was completely broke and about to, you know, I had literally started packing to go back to Maryland, and he hired me at The Voice. And Norman Mailer and Ed Fancher, who were the original founders of The Voice. Ed Fancher is a psychoanalyst. He's now 90 years old. And still, like, you know, he's still there. He's like spry, and, you know, there was a party for him a little while ago. But yes, all of them were a real influence. Their writing was infused with energy, but also they were individuals. They were not going for a consensus. And Mailer was never really funny, but the others were really, I mean, Kael could be just an incredibly funny writer. Gore Vidal, an incredibly funny writer.
And I assume you think of yourself as a funny writer. I find you to be a funny writer.
Well, I do. I try to, you know, I try to be funny without being jokey. And so sometimes you have to rein it back. And there are a lot of pieces where, you know, where humor, where comedy doesn't work. But one of the things about, for example, Pauline although I didn't dedicate to it, but someone like Manny Farber, a lot of times the comedy in their work doesn't come out from a joke or a one-liner. It comes out from, like, a way that they describe something that's so intense and visual, almost cartoonish, that it makes you laugh. They're not really going for a laugh, but there's a laugh because there's such a compression of energy. And it isn't something I go for because you can't force it, but that's sort of what you're going for. Sometimes it's just like what's funny is a description rather than setting someone up as a prop and then, you know, using them as a punchline. That I try not to do. And it is true that humorless writers, I mean, they really have to fight to hold my attention. I mean, and often you meet writers who have no sense of humor, and I'm telling you, like, the conversation just drags.
Mm. James Walcott is the longtime culture critic and blogger for Vanity Fair. His new book is Critical Mass, Four Decades of Essays, Reviews, Hand Grenades, and Hurrahs, and it's published by Doubleday. James Walcott, a great pleasure. Thank you very much for spending time with us. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you. It was great fun.
Great pleasure. Thank you. Again, the title of the book, Critical Mass. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.